Hi there. I'm just realizing that there's an interesting influence from the way I think on the way I teach bread baking. Or maybe it's the other way around. My name is Zach Martinucci, and this is Against the Grain. I'm finding that whenever I have to do something new, particularly when a new system has to be put in place, a new cooking class lesson plan, a new shift schedule, a new delivery route, even at home if it's a new way I want to try organizing my bedroom, these decisions only consistently turn out well when they're my own decisions. That is, the systems only seem to really work in a lasting way when they come from within. Let me try to explain what I mean by that. When it came time to develop the sourdough class I wanted to teach for home bakers, I had to figure out what would be in that class. How long would the class be? Let's start there. The bread we're making typically rests in the fridge overnight, so initially I thought this was a two-day class. Maybe 1 6-hour day and then another 2-hour day. It seemed necessary, but maybe too much to ask of students or myself. Whose instructions should I use? Should I just copy from the Tartine book? They've definitely got it right. Should I write my own instructions? And if I did, what would I possibly have to say that hasn't already been said by Chad Robertson or Ken Forkish or Jeffrey Hamelman or Nancy Silverton or Michelle Suas or, you know, any of them? What are we going to do during the bulk fermentation, that time in the bread-making process where the dough just rests for 3 hours? But I can't send them home because we have to do a fold every 45 minutes. In bread school, we would just make more bread or learn bread theory, but there's only so much to make and say in an intro sourdough class. And this list of questions goes on. I want to say that I now have a great appreciation for anything that I recognize was built from scratch, especially in small business, but big ones too, because I know that someone at the beginning had to grapple with all of those endless questions so that their thing could become the full-fledged thing that it is today. And for me, those few questions I named just now reflect some of the core ideas that shaped what my sourdough class has become, so I'll answer all of them as we go. Now, in these situations of having to create something new, it is so tempting to just copy what someone else is already doing. I shouldn't even say tempting, because it usually just seems like the right thing to do is to take something you know works for someone else, and of course tweak it a little bit to make it your own, but you start there. At least for me, though, even with as much as I believe in a remix, trying to borrow a system from someone else never really worked out for me. Here's what happens. I borrow someone else's model. For example, I ask Justine, a close friend from bread school, if I can see and even use the curriculum she teaches to her home baking sourdough students in London. Justine and I are tight. She's like my sassy Jewish British aunt, and I think she subscribes to the same no secrets, no shortcuts mantra, so she emails me a few Word documents. I look through the baking schedule she teaches and the long-form explanations of each step of the bread-making process meticulously explained, and at the recipe she's chosen to use. I can make sense of it all, but it's not the way I would probably lay everything out. I felt like if I were to just facilitate her curriculum, even if it were adapted to our kitchen, it would almost feel lost in translation, and not just because she's British. Actually, we talked about how she borrowed and credited some wording from American baking books. Either way, it just wouldn't be my words. And to me, that means it might not be effective or convincing. I don't think it would have quite the same soul. So I tweaked some things. I took Justine's weekly baking schedule that was written out, and I put it in a table that I would understand and be able to explain, and I reworded it to fit this new formatting. I used our own bread recipe from the bakery, which is similar to all country sourdough recipes, but it's adjusted to Denver altitude and humidity, and it's my favorite version of this kind of bread. And when it comes time to sort through the expansive descriptions in Justine's packet explaining each step of the recipe, well, I try to cut it down, to make it more concise, maybe take out a section, but it wasn't working. It just felt like an incomplete version of someone else's work. So I scrapped it. I started over. I wrote out each step of the bread-making process in my own words, the way I would teach it, and the way it makes sense to me. On top of all that, I added a few new resources that I thought might be helpful to new bakers, like sample weekly and daily baking timelines to help them plan out their week. In the end, I created my own bread class. It wasn't Justine's at all, and I feel like it took me 3 times as long because I spent all that time trying to adapt hers when I should have just started writing my own in the first place. but that's hard to do. And I might not have even realized that's what I needed to do until I had already started the process. Since January, about every 3 weeks I've been teaching small groups of home bakers to make sourdough. Here's what that class looks like. There are six students. It's a one-day class, typically on a Sunday, for both new and experienced home bakers. I'd say we typically get one or two students that have made bread before. And I told them at the beginning that my goal is for them to leave comfortable and confident to start baking sourdough in their home kitchen, or to improve upon the baking they're already doing. Class starts at 9 a.m., and they're encouraged to join us early for coffee and pastries as they settle in. At the start of class, I talk them through their course packets and review what we're going to do together throughout the next 6 hours. I talk about the layout of the morning, how we'll make lunch together. I'm really proud of that part. We make shakshuka, an Israeli red pepper and tomato stew with poached eggs that's perfect for making in your new cast iron skillet you bought for bread, and to use the day-old bread that you'll have. Yeah, that is how I decided to fill the bulk fermentation that would otherwise be downtime, with a mini cooking class and lunch party, which is very much my style. But I'm getting ahead of myself. At the very, very beginning, just after I've introduced me, I ask everyone to introduce themselves and to tell me, and the group, if they've ever worked with dough before, any kind really, pizza, pasta, store-bought cookie dough, and why they're here. I leave that question open. My thesis, the idea upon which I built the class, is that everyone has a different relationship with bread. I want that last question to start getting at this. I tell them that maybe you're here because you want to bake one or two loaves a week to have in the house. Maybe you want to start a small production out of your home and sell bread to neighbors and grow a small business out of it. Maybe you want to experiment with different grains and inclusions, like putting herbs and nuts or rye and einkorn in your bread. Maybe you're here because you actually want to make pizza dough, and this is your start. The point is, everyone has their own reason for and style of baking bread, and so I want you to keep that in mind so you can make the most of the class for you today. To that note, bread is both an art and a science. Some of you are here for the precision of baking, for the process of fermentation, for being in control of every gram of flour in your kitchen. Some of you want to feel the dough and taste and smell each step of the way. Some both. So I teach the class for both perspectives. At every step, for example, we take the time and temperature of the dough, and we describe what it feels and smells like so that everyone can write down the metric that makes sense for them. The packet, I separated each step of the recipe, I decided there are 11 of them, onto its own half page. I tell my students, I wrote down what happens at each step, and it's usually the bare minimum so that you can follow along, just a few bullet points. In class together, we'll get to experience how each step happens, and I'll talk about why, but I only wrote down what. I intentionally left you blank spaces on each page so you can write down words or drawings on the page that make sense to you. And sometimes I ask them to follow along with the notes I wrote as I'm demonstrating so they can match my actions to the words on the page and make sense of it all accordingly. That's my insight. That's how I teach this class. Because just like I believe everyone should have their own way of doing things, sure, inspired by others, remixed, etc., I want people to approach home baking the same way. It's not about recreating someone else's recipe. It's about understanding the recipe well enough so you can feel free to process it in the way that's best for you. I love that this is what the sourdough class is, that the way I apparently teach bread baking is a reflection of my own perspective of learning and maybe living. The funny thing is that these classes started in January, and I didn't realize what was going on here till about a week ago. Cue a conversation with my friend Will. Will and I lived together a couple years ago, and he's the kind of friend I talk to, regrettably, once every 3 months, but like no time has passed at all. Will is a composer and photographer and coder and loves to make things just to figure out how they work and how he can make them better. One of the themes that plays throughout Will's life, kind of like how food and identity plays through mine, is an ongoing debate, maybe fascination, between analog and digital. In the context of vinyl records a few years ago, Will made the case that analog is just better, and that some people just have a desire for better. As one of those people, Will thought, why wouldn't you always choose analog for its superior quality, as long as it's available to you? We talked on the phone the other day, catching up about all sorts of things, and I wish I was the kind of podcaster that recorded my entire life just in case, because this conversation would have made for an excellent interview. Anyway, he was telling me about a photography mentor of his and an exercise they did together, and it all came back, of course, to this age-old debate between analog and digital. Is one better? Is one, digital, ruining the other? Does one, analog, contain a certain soul that can't be reproduced? Can art still be art in both forms? There are a lot of ways you can take this conversation. Will was intrigued by this guy's argument that for professional photography, when the subject matter permits it, analog is the better choice. Not just because of quality. Digital takes great photos, and you can manipulate them however you want. That's actually the issue here. He argues that because you can take as many photos as you want and edit them however you want, all that possibility slows things down. The model can ask to see the photo right after it's taken every time. There are too many ways to adjust the lighting and color and so on long after the photo shoot. Now the photographer has 200 photos to edit and even more to sort through. Digital allows us to try so many iterations of something, but that can also be exhausting. Analog, that is, a camera with film that will need to be developed, forces you to get the photo right the first time. Or maybe you get to choose from 10, but still, your work as a photographer is in the setup, in the thinking ahead, and getting the lighting and the framing and the model set just right so that when you take the picture, it's done. Even though it takes more time to develop, it develops beautifully, and you don't have to sort through 200 nearly identical copies the next day. Digital does a great job with copies, but analog is for thinking. I told Will about an exercise I was doing where you have to handwrite 3 pages in a notebook first thing when you get up in the morning. It's not for content, it's an exercise for your brain, and it takes longer than you'd think. So you think you could type it, that would go faster. But the creator of Morning Pages says, no, that's the point. When you write by hand, you're forced to slow down. Your brain gets to think through entire thoughts as your hand catches up before you have time to quickly delete and retype and delete with a few keystrokes. I stop doing this in the morning, but I keep a notebook with me for when I need to slow myself down, when I need to think, because analog is for thinking. I wrote today's episode by hand. I don't always do that. The idea, though, is that I can type it if I know what I want to say, because typing is just to get the words on the page. That's where digital comes in, for making the copies. Quite literally, digital refers to using digits, ones and zeros, pixels, that string together and make something we can interpret, a copy of the thing itself, broken down and reproduced. And there's definitely a place for that. Once I've figured something out, I like to turn to the digital version to make my new system efficient or automated or repeatable in a way that I couldn't do by my analog self. But I did design it or write it, and that thinking happens elsewhere. I've realized that as a tool for myself, I can choose analog when I need to get through some of that thinking. And so I'm now trying to walk through the world considering where I should copy and where I should think. It's so much easier to copy, to take the digital way out, but I wasn't happy with my copied projects. I wasn't happy with that first draft sourdough class until I took the time to write it out myself. When those issues come up, where I need a new delivery route or to change things on our schedule and I haven't done that before, I often ask my mentors how other bakeries do it, bakeries like mine. And they nearly always reply, "You can't do that. You're your own bakery. You have to do it your way, not theirs. There's no one correct way to go about business, and just because we all make bread doesn't mean we do it the same way." I get it now. Copying can be a starting place, but it only gets you so far. And now when I'm stuck trying to figure out what my solution is going to be, I put down the internet, and even if just for a few moments, I pick up a pen and that notebook and see what my brain comes up with when I force it to slow down, when I try to arrive at my own version that's best for me the first time, when I make myself think the analog way. Bread is also analog. It can be mass-produced, I suppose, but at least on our scale, each batch is unique and it must be made by hand every day. People often come to learn to bake bread because it seems charming in this day and age to make something from start to finish with your hands. And it is. But I'd also add that the best way we learn to make bread is also the analog way. So that's how I teach it. The point of class, or of learning to bake on your own, or whatever it is you do that's your baking, is not to copy the recipe. The point is to see how bread works, and then think through the blank spaces I left you on the page and fill it in with your own words. Not Justine's, and not only mine either. Just because we're all baking bread doesn't mean we should do it the same way. I'd be doing you a disservice if all I did was give you a recipe and taught you how to copy it. I left the blank space, so you're forced to think a little, to consider your own best original version of this technique that's meant to work for you the first time. Some updates for you. To allow myself space to think and not get overwhelmed, I've made a rule for myself that I'll only do one new event per week. Multiple events is fine, but only one new one. I also, however, like to say yes to fun things and people that I like, and so I broke that rule this week. Here's what happened. Last Sunday, I taught a sourdough class, an old event, and a good one. Monday, I taught a new pasta class to my 55 and up community in Aurora, who I love. Unlike some of the millennial date nights I get teaching pasta classes in the evenings downtown, my midday, midweek retirees are there to learn pasta, and I love their enthusiasm. They often demand fresh content, and so they're also my testing ground for new class ideas. This week we made hand-rolled fresh pasta, that is just semolina flour and water hand-kneaded to make a dough, and then all shapes you make by pressing and rolling and squishing the dough using your hands and the table. I think I made a batch of fresh pasta for 3 nights in a row leading up to the class, including my first ever successful batches of cacio e pepe, which was definitely worth it, but I was very glad to be finished with it all on Monday. And it went well, by the way. My one mistake was asking them to hand chop the pesto, like to use just a knife and a cutting board to cut cups of basil into a paste. I enjoy that method on occasion, and I also think I'm a bit faster with the knife. It took 45 minutes. So as much as I wanted to celebrate the slow way of doing things, we'll be using a food processor when I teach this at the bakery. Tuesday, I taught the beloved how to make gnocchi like an Italian grandmother class at the bakery. Wednesday, I took a quick break, went for a hike by myself, took my girlfriend's dog, we shared a prosciutto sandwich for lunch, and then right back into it. Thursday, I taught my first private bagel class, which was more or less our bagels and beer workshop for a former student and her work team as their monthly team building activity. And then Friday, we were asked by our coffee roasting friends at Sweet Bloom to do a catered tigelle event for an evening talk and gathering they were hosting. Tigelle, you might remember, are a bolognese English muffin-like grilled bread that I teach and make at our main interactive dinner. This was the first time, well, really for both of these events, that I was asked to bring bagels or tigelle to a private or catered event. That it wasn't just my thing, but that someone else that knew about my idea thought it would be a really special addition to their event. That makes me really happy. Sometimes it's also confusing, at least perspective altering. It's the kind of thing that's been happening recently that makes me consider the pivot. I have this recipe or class or idea, and I've found the way I really like doing it. And then someone else comes along, really likes the thing too, and asks if I can do it in a different way. Could they do this for company team building? Would you come to our coffee shop and make this? Would you consider this other context? It helps me to see that just because I've found one way of doing things doesn't mean it's the only or the best way. And maybe it'll be a good business decision soon to take some of these things in a new direction if that's what people want. So I'm trying to be open to it. I really believe, after all, that everyone should do things the best way for them. And I love when I get to play a role in making that happen. Next week, thankfully, is a bit slower. I want to tell you about the other people teaching classes at Rebel Bread and how this whole program has shifted how I think about what it means to build a bread school. I'll talk to you next Sunday. This song is You Got the Medicine by Emery.